from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the first of two discussions about social conceptions of art and aesthetics, seen from contemporary and ancient perspectives. First, a discussion about architecture and American social values. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about art and architecture in classical Greek society. The program at hand examines several questions. Is contemporary architecture primarily artistic or technical in nature? To what extent does modern architecture combine humanistic and scientific elements? How does modern architecture address the problems and challenges of urban America? The panelists are Kenneth Severins, George Hartman, Claude McKinney, and Charles Blitzer. Kenneth Severins is a professor of architectural history at the College of Charleston. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project entitled Charleston Antebellum Architecture and Civic Destiny. George Hartman is an architect from Washington, D.C., who designed the National Humanities Center. Claude McKinney is a trustee of the center and serves as dean of the School of Design at North Carolina State University. Charles Blitzer is the director of the National Humanities Center. Before coming to the center, he served as assistant secretary for art and history at the Smithsonian Institution. Here is Kenneth Severins.
One of the things that is important to me is that with all the literature on architecture and probably better access to architecture than there ever has been in the history of mankind, architecture is really quite unpopular as an enterprise in the contemporary world. The populace, it seems to me, doesn't have a very clear idea, and if it does have an idea, it tends to be negative. And even architects themselves tend to question their work, their roots, their prospects for the future. And I think it's a result of a series of problems. One of them, quite obviously, is a change in patronage. Patronage of the past has always emphasized a person or a body of people who have control over the process of building, and they convey very clearly their ideals to an architect. Whereas today, a number of clients can be described as amorphous bodies without really an idea of what they want other than the satisfying of functional requirements, needs, and so forth. So I think patronage has something to do with it. I think within the architectural profession itself, there are problems. One has gone through a period of 50 years of very intense discussion of what architecture is, and at this point in time, many of the basic principles that were thought to be eternal are being questioned.
George, let me ask you to tell me what an architect is.
Let me answer this slightly tangentially. The architectural profession is not a uniform, very cohesive block. It varies quite widely. I think I have more in common with my contemporaries in Europe and Japan than I do with many of the people that are across town. There's a real question in the architectural profession whether what we're doing is putting up technically sound buildings, catering to a social need, or creating an art form. And depending, obviously we're doing all of these, but depending on where you put the balance, you can locate yourself within the profession. There is no way you can get art from a technician or a consummate technology from most artists. And if you see the process of building architecture as building a social program, you may want another kind of architect altogether.
When you say a social program, you mean what, a social statement of some sort?
Yes, I'm referring really to the fact that now in the architectural and planning professions, so-called advocacy planning, where you endeavor to get the client to do the building, and of course we're all very interested in getting the client's input so that the buildings are different one from another. However, there is no way, no matter how talented the architect is, that in the end the client can design it and have it turn out to be first-class art. So you have to know when to let go and when to regain control and then begin to shape the result of all this activity. I'm saying that the client has to keep control of all those aspects to be sure that he's getting what he wants, and at the same time allow the freedom and flexibility for the architect to design it. There's no reason. Architecture is one of the last of the commissioned arts, and is, as such, is somewhat unique. It has always been this way, but it's never been considered restrictive of the great architects of the past, that a pope or a prince or someone would come to them and request a given program.
This is Ken's field, but Gideon has told us that history is not a compilation of facts, but more insight into a moving process. And I think that perhaps as much as anything has been missing in a lot of the education of today's architects. You know, the history is growing enormously in terms of content, and there's much to learn, and we tend to fragment it and channel it more and more into disciplines rather than look at it as an ongoing process. Consequently, architecture can be looked upon as itself just a description of building form from an aesthetic standpoint, when in fact it is a reflection of a society which generated not an individual artifact but a combination of them through environments that we refer to as communities or neighborhoods or cities. And I think that was something that George Hartman was talking about, this concept that architecture is not property line, a property line art, that architecture relates to the context in which it's placed, whether it's a pine wood setting as the Humanities Center is, or whether it's the middle of Constitution Avenue in downtown Washington.
I'd like to continue what Claude has brought up, the idea of architecture as expressive of the age in which it was produced. This is one of the most important things, in my opinion, in the training of an architect, investigation of how architecture of the past has reflected values and ideals and aspirations. And it seems to me that one of the things that architectural history can do is to show in a very convincing way the role of the architect as a molder and shaper of common ideals and values of his society, and this ought to be a very central part of his activity. And I think this has been true of many of the great ages of architecture, that there has been a vision that has gone beyond the basic needs, and it creates something that we revere historically and which in turn becomes educational for architects going through the process of learning about what architecture is.
Can I add a couple of things? First, I want to add my personal testimony to the triumph of George Hartman in designing this building. And I think what's been said already is absolutely correct. It was a happy combination of the right architect and clients, including Claude McKinney and Charles Frankel, the first director, who knew what they wanted. But there are a couple of things that have been said that I'm curious about. One is the notion of the importance of knowing the history of architecture in order to practice it properly. I seem to recall having been told that when George Gropius ran the School of Design at Harvard, he came very close to getting it disaccredited, if that's the proper word, by completely dropping the history of architecture. And when he was told that he had to have it, he summoned his faculty and in a kind of lighthearted way said, let's throw some of this in just because they tell us we have to do it. But that's really no way to design good buildings. We should wipe out the past and create a new architecture. And the other thing on the last point, that it seems to me there are cases where the same kind of boosterism or the same kind of great vision has worked out not very well. I'd be curious about why some work and some turn out to be what I think of as the Ozymandias complex. I spent a couple of days in a city in Yugoslavia called Titograd that Tito decided would be created in the middle of no place as his monument, and I guess it was 2 or 3 years old when I was there, and it was dead and crumbling and horrible. I gather that's very much what Louis XIV said should happen at Versailles. That work, Tito Grad, didn't. I don't know what you professionals think about Brasilia and whether that's going to work or whether Corbusier's Chandigarh in India is going to work, but it seems to me it was just that kind of boosterism and vision that worked in Raleigh, that worked in Charleston, that at least in some cases in the modern world is disastrous. If I could just add one other thing, I'd be curious. I'm the amateur in all of this. If anything, I'm a client or a consumer of architecture, not an expert on it and certainly not an architect. But are we in fact talking about a tiny number of all the people who are practicing architecture in this country? And isn't the vast number of architects a group of people who sort of turn out cookie-cutter buildings whose names nobody knows, who in fact have more impact on what we see and what we feel when we live in this country than people like George and a dozen others that all of us could name?
I think that's true. We really, and when we're discussing serious architecture, I think we're talking about at the most 10% of the architectural profession. There are reasons why this number is so small. I think it's always been a small group, but I think we can trace some of this to the modern movement of which Gropius was representative. I think in his abolishing of architectural history at Harvard, and deciding that the standard Bauhaus way of going about things was, in order to design a brick wall, it was necessary to go out and learn how to make bricks. And so a certain amount of time was spent doing this. And only then, after you'd figured out how to make them and were quite expert at making them, could you proceed to address the problem of piling them up in certain orders and arrangements. The modern movement, in terms of its impact on architectural history, caused a lot of fragmentation. Prior to the modern movement, there was no difference between an architectural historian and an architect, and all architectural history was handled by architects. The modern movement, in part by, although architectural history, of course, predates the modern movement, but it allowed the beginning of a fragmentation to come in, and increasingly specialization came in. Suddenly there was a burst of technology where mechanical systems, which were virtually missing in all of classical architecture, heating, cooling, electrical, and so on, began to take more and more of architects' time. And so that came in, of course, at the expense of other things. When the modern movement was a reaction to the abuses of the École des Beaux-Arts, and what we got then was that the modernists became all revolutionaries in one form or another, and therefore set out to make a break with the past. Now, when this happened, they proceeded to give the public 50 years of modern architecture, and the public responded, as we well know, in the last 10 years, with 10 years of the greatest wave of architectural preservation, that is, preservation of the buildings that predated the modern movement, that the world has ever seen, probably will ever see again. A lot of this is, I think, boosterism gone bad. The sudden amount of building that was put in, just in the size of development that came in following World War II, led to things being built more quickly than they could be thought out. Brasilia and Chandigarh, I think, are examples of buildings you can't plan on that scale successfully. It just takes to make the richness that we're used to, whether it's from Rome or Athens, requires hundreds of years of work, and it's very hard to do it in 10 or 20 years after a major war.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion about architecture and American social values. The panelists are Kenneth Severance, Charles Blitzer, George Hartman, and Claude McKinney. Kenneth Severance recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project about American antebellum architecture and the concept of civic destiny. He's an architectural historian at the College of Charleston. Charles Blitzer is the director of the National Humanities Center. George Hartman is an architect from Washington, D.C. Claude McKinney is Dean of the School of Design at North Carolina State University and a trustee of the National Humanities Center. Here is Kenneth Severance.
I think I'd like to pick up on Charles Blitzer's comment about the distinction between those architects doing the good buildings and then those other architects who turn out the ordinary. I guess I would like to describe them as junior high schools. I think of that as a category of building. And George Hartman has said that there's about 10% of the architects practicing who are involved in this aspiring kind of architecture that seeks to make a statement about the times and so forth. I think the thing that bothers me about this distinction is that if we applied those same figures to the other professions, we'd be in real trouble as a society. For instance, if we said that only 10% of the lawyers do good law, and even worse, if we said that if only 10% of physicians do good medicine, I think we would be in real trouble as a society. And the problem as I see it is that there is good architecture being done today, but there has been a great difficulty in broadening the percentages of architects working in that category, and even greater problem, perhaps, of getting the people as a whole to recognize the distinction between that architecture, which is making a statement about the times, and the architecture that is warehouse-like in the way it encloses human activities.
Unless the latter is, in fact, also making a statement about the times, which is what worries me a little bit.
That could be true. But I think we've gone through our fascination with pop culture and pop architecture and things like that. I think people are wanting something that is more substantial, more lasting, more meaningful, and I don't think it's possible simply to say that our world is so pluralistic, so common in terms of its everyday elements, that our buildings need to reflect this entirely. I'm not saying that every building should be a monument, but yet at the same time, it would be, an improvement if we saw architecture filtering its way into more aspects of everyday life than it does at present.
And I think that's useful to make the distinction. One of the problems with the modern movement that has come to us is the notion that every building should be a monument, the notion that buildings should be freestanding, if at all possible, and that buildings should be focal points, objects in a landscape. The difficulty with the profession right now that this has left us with is that we're coming to a period now where it's really the gropiest attitude towards architectural education that has trained most of the profession, and certainly has trained the bulk of the teachers in the profession, so that there's going to be a very slow shift to a more comprehensive attitude that ties back to the previous work, so that it's difficult for many people to adjust.
There is a great temptation in this profession to succumb to the economic benefits, because it can be a very lucrative one if you run it as a business. And we tend to have a developer kind of engine determining what is built and how it's built and how much it's cost and so on. We have, in a relatively short period of time, developed a very large country with a variety of cities that reflect a lot of our ethnic heritages. So there is little that you can refer to in this country as being uniquely American. We are reflections of our ancestors, I suppose. But in speaking of architecture in the American city, it is not the individual building that we can talk about. We have to talk about the aggregate expression of places where we live, we worship, we shop, we work, we recreate, etc. And it is the aggregate which makes architecture the reflection of who we are and what we are aspiring to be. And I believe that we are beginning to rediscover the quality of public life in this country in places that aren't necessarily that facilitating of public life. It's very hard to think of very many places in New York that could be referred to as the place for the expression of New York's public life. It is easier to express it in a small town in New England, which has a commons, or in the courthouse square in eastern North Carolina in a small town, where there was a development of a place in which that could be expressed, whether it's the town hall or the commons or the aggregate number of buildings which form the west walls, south, north, and east-west walls of the commons. We have experimented in the last 25 years with some city building process. They have not, those processes have been generated generally by developers, not by architects. Architects have been retained as professional individuals. And rather than the Wrens who might have shaped a city life, you're talking of James Rouse in Columbia, Robert Simon in Reston, George Mitchell in Woodlands, going back 50 years, perhaps Clarence Stein in some of the concepts of places where people live. But what it has done is made us reflect more about the quality of our urban centers and has had an impact on the revitalization of the American city. The things that we've seen happen in Boston and Baltimore and New York and other places now, Norfolk.
I agree, it seems to me. I don't want to be too personal, but having just moved to Durham, North Carolina, I was reminded of Gertrude Stein's line about Los Angeles, that when you get there, there is no there there. I found it hard to find where Durham is, and I think what I've found now is that where Durham is on the whole is in shopping malls, and that's where people get together. And if you go to one on a Saturday night, the kids are all hanging out there and playing video games and eating fast food, and their parents are sitting around by the splashing fountains and going into the department stores. And I don't mean to put that down. If you put that in Italy and call it a galleria, it's a big deal. If you put it here, people are scornful about it. But I don't know if it's the responsibility of architects to shape our social values or to respond to what they find. And somehow it seems to me that I'm not enchanted myself by shopping malls, but that they do seem to respond now to the way people live.
Tom Wolfe is perhaps a blasphemous name to bring into a discussion about architecture. Says that he believes that that's the one of the art forms of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Whether you like it or not, whether it's vernacular or whether it's been professionally formed, it is an expression of our society. I'd like to think that that will evolve into something.
What about that, George? Do architects, in your view, shape or reflect larger social concerns and values?
I don't think that architects, aside from some of the strong egos at the height of the modern movement, it's a bit much to say that you're going to shape them. We certainly do reflect them. I think the evolution from the great railroad stations to the airports to the freeways, and now if the current expression, I think you may be quite right, Charles, that the current expression is the shopping center, and it's the highest communal architecture form that we've developed at this point. I think there are reasons for this. We're fighting a resistance to, there's less and less reason to come together as technology advances. We're encapsulated more and more in our houses. Instead of going to the piazza because it's cool for a drink with your friends, what you do now is you go home to your air-conditioned apartment for a drink with your wife. I'm not sure that one of these is better than another, but they have very different urbanistic implications. And as the technology advances with the computer, there's maybe even less and less reason to even go to work. So that technology is working against the social impact of the business of coming together, and the last reason to assemble is to acquire the things that you need in order not to come together. And that, of course, is why the shopping center is the last holdout for this. There is another thing that's come in, though, is that now I think people are beginning to wonder about what has happened to the quality of life in the time that we've done this, which has been very short. All the founders of the modern movement, Wright, Mies, Corbusier, were all anti-urbanist. in every sense, Broadacre City as an anti-urban concept. Mies was always interested in individual buildings as opposed to the way they related, and we have ample literary sources from Corbusier as to the horrors of the city as he found it in Europe when he began to go into the Ville Radieuse type of planning. And we're just now coming around to finding out that, and it was interesting to me that the city was abandoned at the one point that the technology came to make it work. If you've ever spent a year or even a summer in a medieval town, you realize that they're very hard to live in. The noise, the congestion, the whole thing is just awful. On the other hand, it's visually wonderful to visit. Just at the time with the air handling systems and all the rest, so that we could live there comfortably and shut out the traffic noise and the carts and everything else, it was just at the time when we started to move away from them. And we're beginning now to see that we may have simply given up too much, and that good urbanism may yet come back, not because it's necessarily practical or required, but because people want it. And it produced a quality of life that can't be found anywhere else. I think when we look at the great cities we have, they all predate the modern movement, whether it's Charleston, Savannah, wherever. The places that are most successful at this point are subgroupings within major cities, maybe Georgetown, Alexandria, the same types of communities in Boston, San Francisco.
Could I ask another? I think I ask this because I've just been reading my Smithsonian colleague Roger Kennedy's book about American churches, which I thought was marvelous. And maybe because of that, I have a feeling that architects and modern architects in this country have done pretty well with that form. Am I right? Is that your impression, that they've been inventive and produced really some marvelous buildings, or is it just because Roger is so good at picking out the few good ones?
I think they're good examples. Certainly, that is... You get into an area, I think Roger has picked out the good ones. I think that's absolutely true. But I would say that probably there are more good churches than any other single building type. In part, that's a building type that frees up from the technical constraints generally, and everyone is interested in the expressive and emotive implications of building, which moves it very quickly to an art form, and therefore in a building type like that, assuming the client really wants what they ought to want, then the only thing standing in the way of success is the quality of the architect. And that has worked out very well. It's interesting for us that half of our National Honor Awards have been for churches.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the first of two discussions about social conceptions of art and aesthetics. The panelists were George Hartman, an architect from Washington, D.C., Claude McKinney of North Carolina State University, Kenneth Severance of the College of Charleston, and Charles Blitzer, director of the National Humanities Center. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about art and society in ancient Greece. My guest will be Mary Sturgeon, an art historian and classical archaeologist from the University of North Carolina. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me for the first of two discussions about social conceptions of art and aesthetics. This week, Soundings presents a conversation about architecture and American social values. The panelists include academic and professional experts on architecture and art history. At issue are questions about the artistic and technical elements that constitute architectural theory and practice, the humanistic and scientific sources of modern architecture, and the ways in which contemporary architecture addresses American urban issues. Social Aesthetics, Part 1, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.